A year ago, state legislators passed House Bill 2. It's a controversial law that almost immediately set off a national debate about public safety, common sense, and government authority. At the heart of the debate is a room we don't think about much, except perhaps when we're in a long line at a basketball game or we need a quick stop on a road trip. Bathrooms. We seem to take public bathrooms for granted, and for most people, deciding which one to use is not complicated. But North Carolina's public bathrooms came into the national spotlight this year. Among other things, House Bill 2 requires people to use the public bathrooms that correspond with the sex listed on their birth certificate, focusing on their anatomy, not their gender identity. For transgender people, the law led to plenty of confusion.
The day that it passed, I had to pee, and I was like, all right then, what do I do?
Luke Duvey was a 17-year-old junior at Panther Creek High in Cary that day. He was born a girl, but by his sophomore year, identified as a boy. He cut his hair short, started wearing men's clothes, and started taking testosterone to help with the transition. He hasn't had sex reassignment surgery yet.
Do I go into the girls' bathroom now, as it's technically illegal for me to go into the guys' bathroom? But if I go into the girls' bathroom, the social backlash it could have of, oh, a guy just waltzed into the bathroom.
Some estimates have North Carolina with an adult transgender population in the tens of thousands. In more than 200 cities and counties across the United States, some protections have been given to people who are transgender. And in thousands of others, there are none. From North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, I'm Elizabeth Baer.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi. And today, a state divided. HB 2 and transgender rights, a special report by North Carolina Public Radio. This hour, we recap the last year in North Carolina through the lens of House Bill 2 and take a deep dive into this complex chapter of the state's history. HB 2 has grabbed headlines for the last year, but this story really began a couple of years ago with efforts to add Charlotte to the list of cities that protect people regardless of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. And that sparked immediate opposition from Charlotte residents.
Once again, this city council and you, Mrs. Mayor, have divided this city, raised the passions and anger of many on both sides, and pitted the good people of this region against one another.
That mayor was Democrat Jennifer Roberts. She and Charlotte City Council members heard from residents for months.
Next item is the non-discrimination ordinance.
Then there was a marathon council meeting in February of last year. 140 people spoke, and following 3 hours of public comment, the council passed a city law protecting LGBT people.
7-4, and thank you very much for your attention.
Those cheers in Charlotte followed weeks of warnings from Raleigh. State lawmakers discouraged local leaders from passing any sort of measure, promising a swift response.
A day after Charlotte's ordinance passed, the Speaker of the North Carolina House vowed to take action. And a few weeks after that, state lawmakers were back in Raleigh.
The House will come back to order.
Things moved quickly during that one-day special session. Republicans had drafted a bill, but it wasn't immediately available to everyone. Citizens, press, and Democratic lawmakers didn't get a glimpse of what was coming until moments before the debate began. During a committee meeting, State Representative Bobby Richardson, a Democrat from Franklin County, underscored the confusion.
Is it a possibility that we could be given at least 5 to 10 minutes to read this for ourselves from front to back? Because right now, I'm not sure of what is really in this bill.
Bills usually don't become laws in a day, but House Bill 2 moved through both chambers in a matter of hours. It was the beginning of months of divisive rhetoric.
Still, the bill had the support it needed. Republican Buck Newton echoed the refrain of many conservatives on the Senate floor that day.
City Council of Charlotte lost their mind and decided to embark upon a very radical course.
Newton and other Republicans said the bathroom bill was about protecting women and children by keeping men out of women's bathrooms and locker rooms. However, they offered virtually no evidence supporting concerns over public safety. Democrats warned that there would be federal legal challenges and economic repercussions. Other opponents, like Chris Groh of Equality NC, pointed to other cities where similar measures have been in place for years.
This would be the most sweeping anti-LGBT bill in the nation. We cannot allow state policy to be crafted or passed for political gain or out of factless fear.
The most well-known provision of House Bill 2 is the way it legislates who can go into which bathroom. But the law also bans cities and towns from passing their own non-discrimination ordinances. In addition, it creates a statewide non-discrimination law that leaves out the LGBT community.
Following hours of contentious debate, lawmakers sent the five-page bill to Republican Governor Pat McCrory, who signed House Bill 2 into law that night. The chaotic day was over. The fallout was just beginning.
The line has been drawn in North Carolina on the use of public bathrooms for transgender individuals.
That threatens billions of federal school dollars for the
state. U.S. Justice Department and the state of North Carolina sued each other.
5 days after Governor McCrory signed the law, the lawsuits began. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit asking the courts to overturn HB 2. The lawsuit raised a number of legal claims, including violations of equal protection and privacy laws. 28-year-old Joaquin Carcaño is one of four individuals challenging the state law. He spoke at a news conference announcing the lawsuit.
We are no different than any of you. We exist. You've passed us on the street, whether you've known it or not. I guarantee that you've shared a restroom with us. We use it, just like you, to pee. In peace, with privacy, and without fear, instead of with anxiety that has gripped my chest since this legislation has passed.
Plaintiffs say that the law denies them basic rights outlined in the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution because it discriminates on the basis of sex and sexual orientation. They also say the law is an invasion of privacy for transgender men and women.
1 week after the bill became law, North Carolina saw the first concrete financial consequence of HB 2. PayPal, the online payment website, scrapped a plan to invest more than $3 million to expand to North Carolina and hire 400 people.
PayPal CEO Dan Schulman said the law perpetuates discrimination and contradicts his company's values. In a statement, Schulman said, quote, "Becoming an employer in North Carolina where members of our teams will not have equal rights under the law is simply untenable."
PayPal was among the first cancellations.
Then musicians like Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam, and Ringo Starr pulled concerts.
Academic conferences also went away.
Visitor bureaus and mayors reported losses in the millions, and there were warnings of bigger events going elsewhere.
But for all the widespread criticism of House Bill 2, there were also many passionate supporters.
To the Speaker of the North Carolina House, Tim Moore, we say thank you!
In mid-April, hundreds of people stood on the lawn of the old state Capitol building in Raleigh, cheering Governor McCrory and the Republican legislators who wrote the law.
This is a day that the Lord has made.
Speaking at the rally, Republican State Senator Buck Newton pointed a finger at LGBT advocacy groups who, he said, were orchestrating an attack on the state.
They insist on forcing us to bow and kiss the ring of their political correctness theology.
LGBT rights groups and other opponents staged a counter-protest across the street.
Real Christians don't hate! Real Christians don't hate!
When the chants did die down, it was only brief. April rolled into May, and the debate roared on, spreading from the streets of downtown Raleigh to the national airwaves. And it was McCrory, the former seven-term mayor of Charlotte turned governor, who emerged as the bill's biggest advocate.
McCrory had long been seen as a moderate Republican before taking residence in the executive mansion. He attacked what he called the radical media, outside groups, and Hollywood's elite for misrepresenting the measure, and he defended the bill on Meet the Press.
What we've got to do is deal with this extremely new social norm that has come to our nation in a very quick period of time and have these discussions about the complexity of equality while also balancing the concept of privacy.
As the HB2 conflict grew, McCrory's re-election fight was also heating up. His challenger, Democrat Roy Cooper, was raising more money and had a lead in the polls. Both used HB2 to raise the stakes of an already contentious gubernatorial race.
And as the issue went national, so too did the legal maneuvers. Governor McCrory filed a lawsuit asking federal courts to keep HB2 in place. That same day, the U.S. Justice Department responded with a lawsuit of its own.
They created state-sponsored discrimination against transgender individuals.
That's then-U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announcing the lawsuit. Lynch said federal laws concerning gender and discrimination are clear and that North Carolina's law violates them. According to the federal lawsuit, HB 2 violates the Civil Rights Act by discriminating against state employees and Title IX by discriminating against students at state schools. The Obama administration interpreted Title IX to also cover gender identity, although the Trump administration rescinded that rule last month.
None of us can stand by when a state enters the business of legislating identity and insists that a person pretend to be something or someone that they are not, or invents a problem that does not exist as a pretext for discrimination and harassment.
Governor McCrory vowed to fight Washington, while his challenger for re-election made the loudest calls yet for repeal. Here's Roy Cooper.
We shouldn't have to be dealing with these lawsuits in the first place. This shameful new law has brought them upon us. The governor and the legislature should repeal this law.
The legislative session marched on into June and July. Policymakers passed a budget and actually tweaked HB 2 before adjourning. However, that adjustment dealt with legal recourse and the ability to sue in state court over wrongful discrimination. The bathroom provision remained, and so did the national controversy.
House Bill 2 would soon disrupt one of the state's most cherished staples, basketball.
And they're going to let it run out. It's all over. The Tar Heels are the Atlantic Coast Conference champions.
College basketball is ingrained in North Carolina culture. People remember teachers rolling televisions into classrooms to watch March Madness games during their childhood.
Basketball culture and the bathroom controversy collided, and that moved the stakes to a new level. First, it was the National Basketball Association. Charlotte was scheduled to host the 2017 NBA All-Star Game, but League Commissioner Adam Silver warned there would be consequences.
There's a long track record in this league of being in the forefront on issues impacting human rights and discrimination. And of course, this league, and I think I speak for all leagues, is against discrimination in any form.
In July, the NBA pulled its All-Star Game from Charlotte. It's an event that generates about $100 million for its host city.
2 months later, the NCAA pulled seven college championship games from the state, including NCAA's men's basketball. And the ACC followed, pulling 10 championships, including women's basketball and soccer, golf and tennis, in addition to football. The city of Cary was especially hard hit. Mayor Harold Weinbrech estimated the NCAA's decision will cost the city about $2 million.
We're an NCAA championship city, which means we host NCAA championships, and now we're an NCAA championship city, and we don't host NCAA championships. So it's a major loss because we put a lot of time, money, and effort into becoming an amateur sports mecca.
Meanwhile, North Carolina was also becoming a mecca for partisan bickering. The state's population has grown significantly, and its political makeup has changed. The state is no longer firmly red when it comes to presidential races. In 2008, Barack Obama's closest victory came here. 4 years later, voters handed President Obama his narrowest defeat. House Bill 2 was a perfectly polarizing issue.
That's, to me, the perfect definition of a wedge issue.
Meredith College political science professor David McLennan says with a national rise of populism, House Bill 2 highlighted a divide. Religious rural areas where the economy is still sputtering following the recession, and growing urban regions pushing progressive agendas. In addition to Republican Governor Pat McCrory, other candidates champion the socially divisive legislation. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, seeking re-election, and Buck Newton, vying for attorney general, regularly use the issue on the stump. Forrest won comfortably, Newton lost, and McCrory came up short, losing by less than 11,000 votes. While many were quick to cite HB 2 as the reason for McCrory's defeat, McLennan, the political scientist, says it's not that simple.
He also had some other issues that were sort of driving his ultimate defeat. So even though HB 2 was an important issue in his race, and I think probably cost him some percentage points in the race, what caused him to lose was the combination of all the issues.
The election was over, but the issue of House Bill 2 remained. Pressure persisted, and in early December, rumblings of a special session grew. Lawmakers first came in for an entirely unrelated effort, stripping the governor's office of some powers.
A week later, in the days before Christmas, state legislators convened again. A deal had apparently been brokered by Senate Leader Phil Berger, House Speaker Tim Moore, and Governor-elect Roy Cooper to repeal the law. If Charlotte would rescind its ordinance, which, to be clear, had already been nullified by HB 2, then state lawmakers would follow and undo the bathroom bill. Members of the press descended on the legislature as a national spotlight intensified on Raleigh again.
But there was no deal. Republicans blamed the Charlotte City Council for at first only rolling back part of its ordinance. Democrats pointed the finger at Republicans for not sticking to the deal,
Why the agreement fell apart is a question that legislators on both sides of the aisle asked themselves in the days that followed the December special session. The answers, of course, depend on who you ask.
For Luke Duvey, the transgender high school student from Morrisville, the failed measure offered further disappointment. Here's his mom, Jean.
Seeing our politicians use fear and marginalize and bring hatred towards a group of people that already is suffering, that was very disheartening.
As 2017 rolled in, the wedge issue was still in place and the law was still on the books. That meant conservatives were holding their ground, progressives had yet to reach a compromise, and the black eye on North Carolina had yet to begin healing. And lawmakers have again failed at reaching a compromise on a second repeal bill introduced in February.
You're listening to A State Divided, HB2 and Transgender Rights, a special report by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. After the break, we take a closer look at HB2's impact on the state's politics, economy, and education, and we recap the legal challenges the law still faces. Welcome back. You're listening to A State Divided, HB2 and Transgender Rights, a special report by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Elizabeth Baer. 1 year ago, House Bill 2 moved through the General Assembly and was signed into law by Governor Pat McCrory. A frenzied political day at the state capitol amplified partisan bickering, triggered unintended consequences, and established a divisive law that remains on the books. This hour, WUNC takes a closer look at some of the impacts from HB2 and what lies ahead. The so-called bathroom bill served as a key political issue in North Carolina last year. It ignited conservatives and progressives, became a regular topic on the campaign trail, and drew attention from around the world. Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff Tiberi explains how House Bill 2 reflected what was happening on a national level.
This time last year, a political firebrand was barreling through the Republican presidential primary on a crash course with American history. Donald Trump eliminated GOP opponents one by one, and while some in the party feared potential down-ballot effects, the candidate invigorated millions.
I think that sort of populism, the sort of rural anger, definitely fueled HB2's rise and I think continued support.
David McLennan teaches political science at Meredith College in Raleigh. He says House Bill 2 arrived at a moment in American politics when divisions between conservative and liberal voters ran deep.
The timing of it was perfect because of the rise of Trump, and the issue itself was one that they could latch onto as more of a symbol of this sort of progressive humanism that has been, in their minds, changing North Carolina for 30 years.
HB 2 is a microcosm of a larger national movement. Rural voters seeking a candidate or issue that bucks liberal agendas and big city politics. There were large, loud, passionate rallies for and against Trump and the bathroom bill.
Government overreach surely must be when they start making laws about where we can pee. So it's Monday in Raleigh.
The raging grannies gathered in downtown Raleigh in opposition to HB 2. A few weeks later, a group of pastors rallied in support of the law just a few blocks away. Pastor Patrick Wooden talked to the crowd.
And we believe that it's bad behavior for a man to have access to the restrooms, dressing rooms, locker rooms, or any place where women go in private to change and to undress.
There were dozens of rallies across the state. One side framed bathroom access as a civil rights issue. The opposition contended it was about protecting women and girls from predators entering bathrooms, although there was no credible evidence to substantiate that as a public safety issue. As election season crescendoed, candidates sounded off on HB2 during speeches, on Twitter, and in campaign ads. Despite an improving economy and lower tax rates, Governor Pat McCrory made the bathroom issue central to his reelection bid. Here he is during a debate, addressing his challenger, Roy Cooper.
And I've been looking for a compromise for months on this issue, but I'll make a deal with him right now. If you agree to take out this gender identity and gender expression regarding access to our schools, locker rooms, restrooms, and showers, I will support in a bipartisan effort to make sure we do not discriminate against the LGBT community in hiring or firing.
McCrory blamed the press, high-profile celebrities, outside progressive groups, and the Obama administration whenever he could. And at every turn, Cooper, the Democratic Attorney General, who refused to defend the bathroom bill in court, took aim at his opponent.
And Governor McCrory continues to go across the state telling people that this is not hurting our economy. He attacks businesses who are opposed to it and says that everything is going fine. Governor, what planet are you on?
Cooper won a very close race, unseating McCrory by less than 11,000 votes. And while it might be tempting to call McCrory's loss a casualty of House Bill 2, that isn't fair. After all, Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest won comfortably, touting HB 2's safety issue all the way to his victory speech. McCrory lost voters in urban areas, and he never made strong Republican allies at the legislature during his years in office. Governor Cooper continues to lead the calls for a repeal of HB 2, but Senate leader Phil Berger holds the high card. He presides over a Republican veto-proof majority and is the most powerful politician in the state.
So I don't think straight repeal is going to occur. I think it's a very difficult thing for that to be accomplished, and I don't know that it satisfies the concerns that people have.
If any fundamental changes to HB 2 do take place in the legislature, bipartisan compromise is needed. Lawmakers aren't there yet, and even if a deal is brokered and implemented, House Bill 2 will likely remain on North Carolina's political stage for years to come.
Legislators have spent much of the past year, even the last few weeks, posturing on House Bill 2's pros and cons without any action to repeal the law. But perhaps the most tangible impact of the law has been on the business front. Because of HB 2, major companies scrapped plans to expand in North Carolina. Sporting events pulled out, and while the long-term effects are still unclear, reporter Jason DeBruin explains what HB 2 has meant for North Carolina's economy so far.
It's quiet at Wake Med Soccer Park in Cary on a recent afternoon. A giant green tarp covers the entire field. The sun's rays reflect off the metal bleachers and hit you in the eye. A chain-link fence door clangs in the wind. The usually vibrant athletic park hasn't been so vibrant lately. To blame are college sports leagues that pulled out of North Carolina following the passage of House Bill 2. Because of the law, the NCAA and Atlantic Coast Conference pulled nearly two dozen championships from North Carolina. The leagues pulled lucrative events from Cary, Durham, Raleigh, and several other cities. Just like that, college sports pulled out of a state that loves college sports. Scott Dupree directs the Greater Raleigh Sports Alliance and has seen the impacts firsthand.
College sports is really part of the fabric of the state, and that's what sort of makes it more personal for so many people here.
Dupree's group works with government officials around the state to attract sporting events here. When these teams come to town, well, so do fans and families. That means heads on hotel room pillows and meals at local restaurants. The economic hit on Cary has been significant, but it's not the only victim of HB 2. Private companies abandoned expansion and hiring plans. Rock stars have canceled shows. Even the NBA relocated its All-Star game. The fiscal damage is estimated to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Cary's mayor, Harold Weinbrecht, became an outspoken opponent of HB 2.
I remember going out to eat one night, and there was an entire soccer team that was playing in the Final Four in there. It took half the restaurant. I mean, that's huge for that restaurant for that night.
It wasn't just sporting events that pulled out of North Carolina. Companies around the nation criticized the bill and vowed never to consider expanding within the state. The business atmosphere was tense following the bill's passage. Was it all just big talk? Well, we found out.
PayPal announced yesterday that they would no longer be opening a global operations center in Charlotte, North Carolina, after the state's passing of the controversial bathroom bill.
The blowback was swift and sizable.
The NFL, NBA, Coca-Cola, and Apple, among a laundry list of others, calling for a veto of the bill.
Even the federal government threatened to pull funding from North Carolina.
What happens next? That is the big question for North Carolina lawmakers. This after the Justice Department issued a harsh warning. Do something about HB 2 or risk losing what some say could be billions of federal dollars.
By some estimates, the economic fallout from HB 2 will ultimately top $5 billion. Now, this alone won't cripple the state's economy. After all, North Carolina has a GDP approaching $500 billion every year. However, it will have an outsized impact on hotels, restaurants, and other attractions. Even if spread over several years, a $5 billion hit is a big deal. Further economic loss still scares many in the area. Take a look at the calendar. In mid-April, the NCAA will run through a bid cycle and plan out all events through the year 2022. North Carolina could be left out completely. Mayor Weinbrecht still holds hope that state lawmakers will come around. He says the impacts aren't just felt in Cary or Charlotte, but around the state.
And especially if the message gets out that you're not a welcoming state, then you're driving yourself toward the bottom in the U.S., and that's what we don't want to be. We want the message to get out there that we're still progressive, that we still do a lot of amazing things in the state of North Carolina.
But the NCAA has been clear. Do something about HB2 or don't expect our business. And if left out of an NCAA bid cycle, Tar Heel cities would feel the impact for years. Scott Dupree explains that's in part because these events perform well here. And the NCAA has already given North Carolina time to repeal HB2.
When they announced in September we're pulling the events from North Carolina, at the same time they said, and we're also going to push the bid window, the bid review process back to give North Carolina more time to get HB2 resolved.
But resolving House Bill 2 seems unlikely. An attempt to repeal the bill failed during a special session in December. Lawmakers are now considering another repeal bill, but it might not come in time to keep the sporting events in this state.
Politically and economically, the question swirling around HB2 is when. When or will the legislature reach consensus and repeal the controversial law? Legally, however, the question is, what now? The ACLU of North Carolina and four individuals sued the state over HB2. That case was put on hold until the U.S. Supreme Court could take up a similar case out of Virginia. Earlier this month, the Supreme Court took a pass on reviewing the Virginia case and sent it back to a lower court. And without a higher court ruling, the plaintiffs in the North Carolina case may not have much of a legal leg to stand on. Reporter Rusty Jacobs explains.
Even before the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear the Virginia case, the Trump administration pulled the rug out from under transgender plaintiffs.
Withdrawing guidance that the Obama administration had sent to public schools on the use of bathrooms by transgender students.
It was big news, covered by national media outlets and programs like CNN's Anderson Cooper 360. The plaintiff in the Virginia case is Gavin Grimm, a transgender high school student. Grimm sued to be able to use the male bathrooms in his high school. His case got help from the now rescinded Obama administration's guidance. That rule said a federal law known as Title IX protects the rights of transgender students to use bathrooms based on the gender with which they identify. But constitutional law professor Greg Wallace says that's an erroneous reading of Title IX.
This regulation allows schools to provide separate toilet locker rooms and shower facilities on the basis of sex.
And he may be right. All the language of Title IX says is that schools receiving federal funds may provide separate toilet, locker room, and shower facilities on the basis of sex as long as they're equal. Wallace says the plaintiffs in the North Carolina case take Title IX's protections too far. He says they're taking a regulation intended to tell people what is not sex discrimination under Title IX
and interpreting it to tell us what is prohibited by Title IX.
So where does that leave Carcano v. McCrory, the North Carolina case? For Joaquin Carcano, everything was going well when the legislature adopted HB2. Carcano is the transgender male whose name provides the shorthand title to what some people say is a long-shot case. HB2 was enacted right around the time he was preparing to celebrate the year anniversary of starting hormone therapy.
A lot of people like to celebrate because it is a marker of progress for you sometimes. And, you know, all that was exciting. Things just, you know, continue to get better and better. And then that felt like it came out of nowhere almost.
Carcano says HB2 was ostracizing, forcing him to confront his status on a regular basis, an exercise he calls mentally exhausting.
The fact that HB2 now existed is something you couldn't escape. Because I have to use the restroom multiple days. I have to think about where I can and cannot go multiple times a day.
His lawyers could try to persuade the federal judge that Title IX protections should apply to transgender students without the federal language to back them up. But they'll also make constitutional claims. The Carcano plaintiffs argue HB2 violates the Constitution's right to equal protection under the 14th Amendment.
The preemptive components of HB2, it's very plain that this was motivated in part by anti-LGBT animus.
Chris Brooks says the bias behind HB2 is clear. He's legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina and lead attorney on the case. Brooke notes that leading GOP lawmaker Buck Newton, a one-time candidate for state attorney general, said HB2 was a fight to, quote, keep our state straight. Brooke points out that in addition to the bathroom provisions, HB2 prevents local governments from enacting LGBT anti-discrimination ordinances. He says this law has caused real harm to the transgender community.
One of the things that this case has underlined for me is how much you just take for granted being able to go to the restroom.
But law professor Greg Wallace, who argues HB2 is constitutional, says the real issue in the legal debate over HB2 is competing privacy concerns.
Why do we have separate bathrooms and locker rooms and showers in the first place? It's because we have different bodies, not different gender identities. We want to protect the privacy and safety interests that arise from our bodily differences.
Joaquin Carcano's case doesn't have a trial date yet, but on May 10th, a three-judge panel will consider a request to block the bathroom provisions of HB2. Last summer, a federal judge ordered a temporary halt to enforcing those provisions, but only on UNC campuses where Carcano works. When a trial is set, it's likely Carcano and the other plaintiffs will stand alone in their legal fight against HB2.
At the heart of the HB2 court case is the question of which bathroom and locker room transgender students are allowed to use in public schools. Under HB2, public school students in North Carolina must use the bathroom that matches the gender on their birth certificate. This presents a problem for transgender students who believe they should use restrooms that match their gender identity. State legislators passed HB2 just as some school districts were starting to pay attention to the needs of transgender students. Reporter Jess Clark introduces us to one of the plaintiffs in the case we just heard about and explains how HB2 has made life much more complicated.
All right, so the sculpture studio is right up this way.
18-year-old Hunter Schaefer is a high school senior at the UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. She was born a boy, but in her early teen years, she transitioned to become a girl with the help of hormone therapy. I caught up with her in the art studio last spring, right after lawmakers passed HB2. Schaefer showed me her work, a large, colorful ball with a knitted snout, looking like something out of a Dr. Seuss book. The sculpture hung by a long cord from the ceiling.
It's kind of like descending into its environment.
For the last year, Schaefer's environment at the UNC School of the Arts has held an extra challenge for her. Schaefer uses the women's restroom at school, but since the passage of HB2, that means she breaks the law each time she goes to the bathroom. HB2 allows Schaefer to use a gender-neutral restroom, but she says there aren't enough of them.
I've considered starting to use the men's restroom, but I don't know how comfortable I am looking and feeling the way I do. Like, that's not where I belong.
HB2 came at a time when many school districts were starting to pay attention to kids like Schaefer. Catherine Archibald is a law professor at the University of Detroit and an expert on the litigation surrounding transgender bathroom access. She says in the past few years, school administrators across the country have stepped up accommodations for trans students.
Schools are now thinking, okay, what is our policy? Most of them didn't have a policy in the past.
Archibald says more and more trans students are coming forward as their issues and identities gain more acceptance and awareness, and as trans students have begun winning their cases in the courts.
So this struggle is certainly not a new one. It's just one that's entered mainstream consciousness in recent years.
In North Carolina, many schools have given transgender students access to single-stall gender-neutral restrooms, a move that's still legal under HB2. Schaefer's case is fairly typical. Before she transferred to the School of the Arts, Schaefer completed her freshman and sophomore years at Broughton High School in Raleigh. There, she told school administrators she wouldn't feel comfortable using the boys' locker room when she changed for gym.
And they wouldn't let me use the women's, so they gave me this staff bathroom to change in.
Schaefer used the staff bathroom to use the restroom, too. But eventually, Schaefer started using the girls' restroom, even though faculty had told her she wasn't supposed to.
But I kind of just disregarded that and used the bathroom that I was comfortable with, and no one ever really stopped me.
Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools went a step further and allowed transgender students to access whichever bathroom matched their identity, meaning a trans girl could use a girl's restroom. But that practice became illegal when the state passed HB 2. Despite growing public support around transgender issues, there are students who are not comfortable sharing facilities with their transgender peers. Chloe Jefferson is a student at Greenville Christian Academy. During the special session state lawmakers held last year to pass HB 2, Jefferson spoke out against a Charlotte ordinance that would have allowed transgender people to use restrooms corresponding with their gender identity.
Changing in front of my girl peers is already intimidating enough. Now we add the possibility of males changing and showering alongside me. This is something that makes me, and I'm sure other girls, even more self-conscious.
This tension is hardly unique to North Carolina. Transgender students across the country are caught in the midst of a national culture war on gender, identity, and religion. And many will be watching how the case against HB 2 plays out in court later this spring.
You're listening to A State Divided, HB 2 and Transgender Rights, a special report by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. After the break, we'll take a look at what science tells us about gender and gender identity, and we discuss what comes next in this chapter of North Carolina history. Welcome back. You're listening to A State Divided, HB 2 and Transgender Rights, a special report by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Elizabeth Baer.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi. After state legislators passed House Bill 2 last year, transgender rights took center stage in North Carolina and across the United States. The question of bathroom access pushed transgender people and their advocates into the spotlight. This happened as other high-profile figures like actress Laverne Cox and retired Olympic athlete Caitlyn Jenner became increasingly public about their own gender identity and transition.
But for a lot of North Carolinians, understanding transgender rights and forming opinions is complicated.
If the transgender is a woman that feels like a man and wants to go to the man's bathroom, he should be able to go to the man's bathroom without being harassed.
22-year-old Bricia Felix was exercising on a recent morning outside the YMCA in Henderson. That's about 45 minutes north of Durham. She pushed her 3-year-old son Miguel along in a stroller. Felix says she's heard about HB 2 and supports a repeal of the law. But she's also concerned about her son's safety in public bathrooms. What scares her most is the moment she has to let him go into a bathroom on his own. Those maternal fears are not specific to transgender people, but of anyone taking advantage of the law to commit a crime.
There are crazy people out there, and I just have the concern about other people acting up and being crazy about it and take advantage of it, and then people get hurt.
Felix's conflicting feelings about HB 2 highlight some of the complicated conversations that have emerged across North Carolina this past year. What it means to be a woman, a man, and what science and our surroundings tell us about how gender identity develops through childhood.
For Felix, talking about gender with her young son has happened in small moments, like when he wants to play with dolls or other toys with specific gender associations. She lets him play with any. His gender also came up during a recent toddler milestone, potty training.
Sometimes either I take him or my husband takes him, and he'll see that my husband be standing up and I'll be sitting down when I take him. But then I started telling him, I'm like, you gotta stand up. It took him a while to understand what standing up has to do with.
For little Miguel, being taught that boys stand up is part of beginning to identify as a boy. But for many transgender kids, it's not that simple. One recent study estimates that 150,000 teenagers and 1.4 million adults identify as transgender in the United States.
And studies show that in contrast to their non-transgender peers, transgender kids are at a higher risk for mental illness, depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide.
What I've seen happen with HB2 is that this puts a lot more stress on these individuals because they can't even make a decision about going to the restroom. They can't go alone.
Dina Adkins directs the Duke Center for Child and Adolescent Gender Care in Durham. She's a pediatric endocrinologist whose patients include children born with genders that aren't completely obvious at birth, as well as kids who are transgender.
Children start to get messages about their gender from the time they are born. Is it a pink bow or blue overalls? Is the hair long or short? Natkin says kids form their gender identity early on, usually from the ages of 2 to 5.
And most parents will know this because they'll know that their child starts talking about boys and girls. And then there are some kids who realize that that age, that they are not a boy and they're not a girl, even though their parents have been saying that to them and the culture around them has been addressing them that way.
To better understand gender identity, Adkin says it helps to think of gender as a spectrum rather than two mutually exclusive categories. Not everyone's internal sense of self matches their assigned sex at birth. And when that happens, Adkin says, it can take a while for people to work through who they are.
People transition socially at different ages. People transition medically, which means usually hormones, at a different time. And then surgically, often much later.
That transition is a couple years in the making for Luke Duvey, the transgender teen we heard from at the beginning of the hour. Duvey is the youngest of four children. He's now 18, a high school senior, and a percussionist in the school's marching band. On a recent evening, Duvey pulled up a YouTube video of one of his favorite band performances. In it, he was still a girl. His name was Carolyn.
Watching the videos, especially because there's like so much in character with the performance going on, I don't really see myself so much as Carolyn then. I see myself as part of the group. And so I think like doing the percussion helped a lot because I didn't have to really change who I was, especially during those moments since we were all one and the same.
Outside of those performances, however, Duvey was changing. He was born a girl, but as a child always felt more like a boy. He hated wearing dresses, preferred his hair short, and had to get lessons from his older sister on how to act more girlish. By his sophomore year in high school, he told his mom, Jean, he identified as a boy.
Jean Duvey embraced her son immediately, though it wasn't always easy.
There were times that were really difficult. There was mourning the daughter that I thought I was going to have. You know, the white wedding, the being there to, when she was birthing children. So there were times I would have to cry.
But then one day, that changed. Jean says she remembers her son coming into her room for a snuggle.
It was still the same smell. It was still the same feel. It was still the same child. And once I could work through and mourn the dreams I had of having a daughter and start to build dreams of having a son, then it was perfect.
Luke and his mom became outspoken critics of House Bill 2, attending rallies and calling for legislation to repeal the law. But for all the public attention they've put on themselves and the issue of transgender rights, they both still fear for Luke's safety, especially when he walks into a men's bathroom. While he looks like a boy now, he hasn't had sex reassignment surgery yet.
There's always a little bit of fear. Some of it's kind of irrational, like, what if I walk into a bathroom and someone's like, hey, why are you going into a stall? Like, why were you in the stall for such a short time? There's always little fears like that that I know really won't go anywhere. But if they do, that's always the terrifying part.
Luke and Jean Duvey hope some of those fears pass when Luke has the surgery, which he hopes to do this summer.
And despite their safety concerns, they and other transgender advocates say speaking out is something they have to do.
Terry Phoenix directs the LGBTQ Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Phoenix says transgender visibility goes a long way toward minimizing misconceptions.
In some respects, the visibility of transgender individuals is going to help because if people start to get to know, well, you know, trans people are not this ogre that people are painting them out to be. I think people hopefully can learn, you know, if they're open to that, I think that they can learn that there are differences.
Those differences, Phoenix says, are easier for some people to understand than others.
People have been taught you're either a male or a female, as if it is a very, you know, clean-cut, absolute fact that is determined at birth. And that there is never any variation on. And so, you know, if you start from that perspective, the idea of gender as a spectrum or the idea that gender identity exists apart from your assigned sex at birth, I think is really somewhat challenging to get your head around.
The conversation over transgender rights and bathroom bills is far from over in North Carolina. This winter, lawmakers failed to repeal House Bill 2 after two attempts at the state legislature.
And last week, the Duke Blue Devils had to play in South Carolina in the second round of the NCAA tournament. The game was initially scheduled for Greensboro, but was moved in response to HB2. UNC also played in South Carolina. Tar Heels basketball coach Roy Williams is one of the most recognizable people in the state. This week, he repeated calls for North Carolina legislators to do something about HB2.
I have a hard time figuring out why we think our law is what's right when 49 other states don't have that. You know, are we that much smarter than 49 other states?
But North Carolina may not be alone for long. Across the U.S., lawmakers in 16 other states have introduced similar bills that would require people to use the bathroom of their sex assigned at birth. Legislation in 13 of those states is pending. In three others, the legislation failed to pass. One of those high-profile bills is moving through the Texas state legislature. There, lawmakers are in the midst of passing a North Carolina-style bathroom bill that would require people to use bathrooms that correspond with the sex on their birth certificates. That bill has drawn backlash from big businesses, including Google, the National Football League, and the National Basketball Association, in much of the same way that businesses criticized House Bill 2 last year. But for now, North Carolina remains the only state to enact this type of legislation, and the controversy over public toilets may be part of America's latest culture war for years to come. Listening to A State Divided, HB2 and Transgender Rights, a special production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Reporters Jess Clark, Jason DeBruin, Rusty Jacobs, Jeff Tabiri, and Jorge Valencia contributed to this report. Robin Copley helped with music. Brent Wolf and Dave DeWitt edited the special. For extended reporting and photos, visit WUNC.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm your host and executive producer, Elizabeth Baer.